Welcome to the Generally Spooky Podcast.
Welcome. I'm Kieran.
I'm Ailey. How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Are you well?
I'm very well. I'm excited. I'm pumped. I'm eager to hear another episode. It's very exciting.
Episode 3, baby.
Episode 3.
You know, it's our third week of season 3. You're kind of settling in.
Mm-hmm.
Getting a feel for how the season is going. The mood, the vibe.
Yep. It's solid so far.
Hope we pass the vibe check.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you passed my vibe check.
Aw.
So, you
know. Cute.
And I just edited episode 1, so I've got that, like, fresh in my brain. Thoroughly enjoyed it. Hopefully you have too, dear listeners. If you haven't listened, you should. It's a good one.
It's a really good story. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting and not something I'd ever really heard of before.
Nope.
Which is a shame, because you should have heard about it.
Yeah. And I've gotten over the trauma of episode 2.
You were a bit traumatised.
I was. It was a bit much.
If you want to hear about Kieran's trauma, then you should join our Patreon.
Yes. Yes, you should.
Because we debriefed after the episode, yep. And Kieran talked a bit about how he processes what I tell him on the podcast. It's very illuminating.
It's
for
good.
People who don't actually know him.
Yeah. Yeah. The lucky few. Well, what do we have this week, or actually before that, is there anything we need to announce?
Yes, there is, Kieran.
Oh, sorry.
A pretty big announcement this week, because we have our first supporter of the podcast.
Woo!
You guys won't believe it. We talked last week about enjoying our Bird and Blend tea, mm-hmm. that I had bought in the Boxing Day sale. Their chocolate digestive tea is one of my favourites. I love it so much. I've loved it for ages, and I bought some, and I put a post up on our Instagram saying, mm-hmm. that we were drinking it, because it's awesome. And Bird and Blend reached out to me, and now they're supporting the podcast.
Yeah, now we're working together.
And I can't really believe it.
So a big thank you to Bird and Blend Tea.
Yes, a round of applause around the microphone. There we go. Yes, they are supporting the podcast. There is a link pretty much everywhere you can find us.
Mm-hmm.
If you click on our Instagram bio, hopefully if you go on the website, it'll be there. Yeah, there's a special link. And if you buy Bird and Blend tea using that link, then we get a small commission.
Yep.
So it's a great way to buy yourself something really, really nice,
mm-hmm.
and support the podcast while you do it.
Yeah. Get yourself an excellent little cup of tea to drink, mm-hmm. while you listen.
Chocolate digestive is top tier,
mm-hmm.
for me. It's my perfect cup of tea because I like strong and sweet.
Yep, it's delicious. That's a black tea.
I'm a pleb, so strong and sweet is the way to go. But you're more of a fruity herbal man.
Yep, I'm more of a hipster, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we had some strawberry lemonade tea of theirs, which was amazing.
I think that's their best seller.
I would believe it. It was that good.
I think it's the one that sells the most over on the website. It was very, very nice.
Yeah.
I will be posting a video of us trying that at some point.
It's really tasty.
But tonight, we're trying a couple of the pile of tea that they sent us, mm-hmm. to try. Because there's a whole, they have so many flavours, and there's so many that we had never tried before. So we're both trying a different one tonight. So Kieran, tell us what you brought.
What tea? What have I brewed?
Mm-hmm.
I brewed some blueberry and peach tea, and it was really tasty. Was very satisfying because this was the one I'm trying is in a tea bag already,
mm-hmm.
and the cup it was brewing in instantly went purple,
which, yeah, it was so bright,
delighted me immensely.
It started kind of a violet Beauregard blueberry color,
yeah,
like the really, really blue, but now, mm-hmm. looking at it, it's kind of like Ribena colored,
yeah,
I'd say. If you're in the UK, if you're not in the UK, I don't really know how else to describe,
yeah,
it, because it's exactly purple. The color of Ribena. Yeah, it's a really, really deep purple.
Yeah, and it's really tasty. And the smell was lovely and peachy, and the blueberry tasted really nice.
Which is strange because it looks super blue and super purple,
mm.
but when you opened up the bag, the peach is what you could smell.
Yeah, you got a big smell of peach, which was delicious. And I'm just thoroughly enjoying it. It is really tasty. What about you, Ailey? What do you have?
Well, mine is a little bit more unusual because my tea is called Birthday Cake.
Birthday cake.
And it's really, really good. I'm really, really enjoying it. I'm having it with milk because I can't help myself. But it has all kinds of nice things in it, including cake sprinkles, which I think is adorable.
That is everything you need in your cup of tea.
But what I really like about it is it's kind of, there's almond pieces in it.
Mm.
So it has that marzipan flavour, which just makes me think of Granny's house at Christmas.
Mm.
Because she would make the Christmas cake and roll out all the marzipan. And that's what it's making me think of. So it's a very sweet, nostalgic cup of tea for me.
Mm. Very unusual.
And I'm having a good time.
Very delicious. Thank you again, Bird and Blend.
Thank you so much. You don't know what it means.
You guys absolutely rock.
It's just a little commission, but it goes a whole long way.
It does. So if you'd like to support us, we really appreciate it if you could use our link.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you go to generallyspooky.com/tea or generallyspooky.com, you'll be able to find it and we'll have it there.
The website's undergoing some changes as of recording this right now.
Yes.
Because we have lots of things in the pipeline. Everything is changing. So it's all kind of, it's very difficult to say where you're going to be able to find things at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
The link is definitely in our Instagram bio.
Yeah.
If you click the link on our Instagram profile, it'll give you a whole list of boxes and the tea one is at the very top.
Yes.
So it's really easy to find. And they're a great company to support.
Mm-hmm.
They care about the environment. They care about their customers. Love them to pieces.
Love it.
So thank you, Bird and Blend.
Thank you. Any other news? Any other announcements today?
I don't think so.
Nope. Come join us on Patreon. We're having lots of fun. Links to that on Instagram and on the website and things.
Mm-hmm. If you want mini episodes and a book club that you can't find anywhere else, then the Patreon is for you.
Yeah, it is.
And that's where we post our weekly blether, which is the two of us chatting.
Yep.
Unscripted, kind of unplanned. It's a good time.
It's a good time.
It's good fun.
Well, with all that said, shall we roll the music and begin? So what do we have today?
Today is kind of a different vibe for mm-hmm. us. We're covering something that's a bit more on the serious side. Something that's very real, as opposed to last week.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking about the Sonny Bean legend last week. This is a real event that happened about 140 years ago.
Okay.
We are talking about a real disaster.
Hmm. Does this mean I have to be serious?
I mean, to a point, yes.
I'll try.
Respectful is probably the better word. Because today we're going to talk about the Tay Bridge disaster.
Oh, okay.
Is this something you'd heard of before?
It's something I've heard of in title, and I think it's very briefly come up on the podcast before. It was one of the William McGonagall's poems was about the Tay Bridge disaster.
Yes, I read a few portions of that poem. Which episode?
I can't remember when he came up.
I think it was the Greyfriars Kirk episode.
Oh, yes.
So episode one of season two.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was supposedly buried in Greyfriars. But there's a bit of debate over whether he's actually buried there or if his memorial was put up just by his supporters after his death.
Mm-hmm.
Because he didn't have enough money to be buried in the portion of Greyfriars where his grave is.
That does make sense.
So, yeah, we've talked about him in the past, and we've talked about him on the podcast and his poem about the Tay Bridge disaster. So that suggests you know a little bit about what happened.
Yeah, but I don't know any details or any specifics.
I was the same. I only ever really knew the basics.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not something that I ever learned about properly. I think I remember just like, hearing about it, but nothing in depth.
No, I don't remember going over it in school or anything.
No.
Not really an engineering class, I suppose. That'd be where you might talk about that.
I really, really wish that we had an engineer or like architect or bridge builder to talk about this episode with, because there's so much detail that I found and I really combed through it and I still don't understand most of it.
Hmm.
It was very technical. I couldn't access a lot of it. So if you're interested in that, that information is available. About the intricacies of bridge building, you're not going to find it here.
Well, we need the gist.
I mean, I tried, so I took an open university course, one of the free ones they have on the website. I took one.
Oh, yeah.
On this. And it helped a lot, but there's a lot of fine detail and calculations that just, I just don't have either the vocabulary or the understanding to try and digest that to tell in the podcast.
Mm. Yeah, you came through after you'd done that course, saying you've just done a course and you were very wide-eyed.
Mm-hmm.
Should I take notes? Is it going to be a maths test at the end?
I mean, if there is, maybe you'll be able to explain things to me.
Maybe.
Maybe. But yeah, like I said, if the technical information and details is what you crave, all that information is out there and all of my sources are always in the show notes. So you can see what I looked at and you can figure it out for yourself. Because I didn't want to explain it wrong. I feel like that's worse than being vague sometimes.
Well, yeah, if it's a disaster, like this is how it happened, and then someone listens and goes, no, it's not. Mm-hmm. That's not even almost what happened. You don't feel like a lemon, do you?
And by that same token, if I say things that are wrong, I love to hear it.
Yes.
Because I like to know.
Mm-hmm. We appreciate corrections.
But it's difficult for me to tell after we've recorded.
Yes.
So do get in touch.
GenerallySpooky@gmail.com or on Instagram or in YouTube comments.
And if you have a ghost story, you can send that over to GenerallySpooky@gmail.com.
That's
because
a good
idea. We will share it here.
Yes, we will. We had a lot of fun reading out your listener ghost stories.
Anyway. You'll be pleased to hear that we are finally not talking about King James the VI.
Aww, he's my favourite.
Finally.
So this disaster didn't happen in the 1600s?
No, we're in a very different part of history today. Much later, much more recognisable to the time we're in today than the time of King James. And I'm effectively starting a countdown.
Okay.
Right now at the top of the episode. We are counting down to the 28th of December, 1879.
Oh, okay, okay.
Because on the 28th of December, a mixture of just bad circumstances, usually unimportant decisions, and bad luck would all come together to cause one of the worst disasters in Scottish history.
Mm.
So we're going all the way back to the late 1700s.
Oh, wow.
So just under 100 years to go.
Jeez, oh.
And we're in the time of modernisation and lots of change. We've talked about this a bit before, but life, as people knew it, was disappearing in favour of industry.
Mm.
People were moving around to find more work. They were moving to cities because there was better money, supposedly. Not for everybody.
Yeah.
And this was the first time that it was sort of feasible to move goods across the country.
Oh, okay.
Which meant that you could sell to more people, which meant you could make more money.
It's one of those things I never think about not being able to do that.
Exactly. And this all started with the canal system.
Oh, yeah.
The people were actually selling and moving goods using the canals before they were using railways.
Mm.
So they would move, companies would move goods, building materials, all kinds of stuff, which is what led to expansion.
Hmm.
One of the biggest changes that came during this period that I'm talking about was the development of cast iron.
Okay.
I'm not going to get too technical here, but I think it's easy to take cast iron for granted.
Absolutely.
Now, like, you don't think about a time in history when it wasn't available.
Mm-hmm.
But the time that we're talking about, because cast iron had been around since the Elizabethan era,
mm-hmm.
a long time, but this was the first time in history that it was able to be produced in huge quantities, which made it quite cheap. Which you'd only been able to make really small amounts of it at once before. It was all different now.
A big foundries being able to like churn it out.
Yeah, it was feasible.
I just have the image in Lord of the Rings of them making all the swords for the Uruk-hai. It's probably not quite like that. You know, they're pouring all the metal.
I don't really know.
Mm.
But the big thing you need to know about this, the reason I bring it up, is that cast iron could now be used in construction, which it couldn't before.
Okay.
Which was a big thing. You could build structures out of cast iron.
Interesting.
Which made them cheaper to build.
Yeah.
So easier to build.
I wonder what it was used for before that. Small items,
tools,
chests.
Mm. Utensils.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Equipment, that kind of thing. Sense. Maybe like even smaller things, locks, hinges. I would imagine. Smaller scale, but now it could be used large scale.
For girders.
Yeah. And we are also in the dawn era of the steam engine. And the steam engine was important. It wasn't just an engine for moving around. The steam engine was powering factories. So the equipment that could mass produce things for the first time were run by steam engines.
That's very cool.
It's a huge cultural shift. Everything has changed. And obviously the steam engine is being used to power ships. So you can move more stuff via ship because the ship can be bigger because you have the steam engine. But steam engines were also powering trains.
My grandpa wrote a book about William Symington, who's thought to be the inventor, because there was like three people who invented it all at once. He wrote a book about one of them. So there you go.
There you go. This is a subject close to your heart.
Yep. I haven't read said book, but it's out there.
It sounds very dense. A lot of detail. Basically, what you need to take away is that everything was changing, and the steam engine and industrialization was just changing the entire landscape of the world. With the rise in the construction and the use of the railways, the need for bridges also rose.
Makes sense.
And it meant that changes were needed in the way that bridges were built, because footbridges weren't cutting it anymore. They weren't strong enough for the size of the engines that were coming over them.
Yeah.
They used to be built with wood, because that was the easy way. But wood bridges didn't last very long. They weren't as strong. They were likely to rot, because bridges are crossing water usually. So the wood just rots away and you have to replace it. So people were moving to using iron and brick to build bridges. A safer move in theory. But you have to remember that people were not experienced at using metal in this way at this point. So they didn't really appreciate that cast iron can be quite brittle. And can break.
You
know, when you take into account things like temperature, stuff like that. And this problem actually led to a rail bridge over the River Dee collapsing while a train was on it in 1847.
Interesting.
And yes, this is foreshadowing.
I was about to say, is this leading up to some sort of disaster?
Unfortunately, yes. So it's just something to bear in mind, that people weren't as familiar with the properties of metal and iron on this scale as they are now. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. It's weird because they probably thought it was indestructible, because you wouldn't have to test it for 50 years, you know? You just have this thing. Or if you'd had like a frying pan that was cast iron that's been handed down through a generation. Like, yeah, this lasts forever. We should make everything of this and it will stand for all of eternity.
Well, I think at this time they appreciated that there was a difference between cast iron and wrought iron. Wrought iron is a lot stronger, but it's a lot more expensive.
Interesting.
Cast iron is a cheaper option, but it's not as strong. And certainly by the time you get to the 1800s and the mid-1800s, people knew that steel was stronger than iron. So there is an understanding of where it falls in the league table of building materials.
Yeah.
But it's still in its infancy as a tool.
And that makes sense.
So now we're in 1849. 30 years to go.
Okay.
By this point, industrialization has exploded. So everything has changed. And now the Firth of Forth and the Firth of Tay were causing problems for people who were living around Edinburgh and Dundee. I can show you a picture, Kieran, and I'll try and have the same picture up in the show notes so that you can look at it. I'm going to show you a picture of the two firths.
I was just about to ask, where is the Tay when it's at home?
There's two pictures, and there's one of just the Firth of Tay and one of the two firths.
Okay, yeah.
Do you see?
I always think Dundee is south of Edinburgh. And I don't know why. Don't know why. I always think that. But it's near Perth.
Yes. So if you are looking at this picture that Kieran is also looking at, you can see that Dundee is separated from the point that has St Andrews on it by the Firth of Tay. And then below that, Edinburgh is separated from like Dunfermline and places like that by the Firth of Forth.
Yes.
And this was causing problems for people trying to travel between the two, as you can imagine.
Well, yeah, if you had to go all the way around, that's a long way, isn't it? Yeah.
If you look at the direct line between Edinburgh and Dundee, it's not really that far.
No.
If you were able to fly directly from one to the other. Mm-hmm. But there are the two forts in the way. And you couldn't go in a direct line like that very easily in 1849.
Yes, that makes sense.
You had two options if you wanted to go from Edinburgh to Dundee or mm-hmm. vice versa. You could take the train, which was option number one, because the railway lines had popped up in loads of places, spanning loads of routes. Everyone was using the train. It was very efficient, and a lot of companies and businesses were moving their goods using freight trains. Mm-hmm. So there were lots of routes. But to do this, you had to go from Edinburgh via Stirling and Perth to get to Dundee.
That's a big detour, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. So you have to go round, avoiding that sort of point that has St Andrews at the tip altogether.
Mm.
Your second alternative was to take two different ferries.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
That cross both of the forts.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you've ever been dependent on a ferry, you know how frustrating it can be and how likely it can be that it can be cancelled.
Yeah.
And then your trip is stuffed. So neither option is ideal.
Mm-hmm. And you can't take, like if you're shipping building materials, you can't fit a train's worth of materials onto a ferry, can you?
It's a slow process.
Mm-hmm.
It's a slow process and you're quite limited in what you can do. Like you said, goods and materials are being shipped across the country at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And shipping them using ferries was not as cost efficient as using the rail
mm-hmm.
because it was slower. So it was costing companies a lot more to do it this way.
Yep. And if there's one way to fix a problem, it's to point out that it's costing companies money.
Exactly. If you want something done, say that people are losing money.
Yep. Save money doing this. Like, oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Well, that was this big time. That was the situation that they were in. And in 1849, a man called Thomas Bush was 26 years old.
Hmm.
He was an engineer from Edinburgh. And after working hard to carve out a career for himself, he was the manager and engineer of the Edinburgh and Northern Railway.
Oh.
Which was a big deal.
That was a big deal.
He was a big deal. Mm-hmm. He was still very young, but he had a good reputation as an engineer. And in 1849, he turned his mind to the issue of the ferry that crossed the Firth of Forth, which is the one closest to Edinburgh, on our little picture, the one that's further south.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he wanted to see if he could make this process more efficient and just generally work better.
That's the definition of an engineer right there.
Exactly.
True to title.
But you might be wondering, he's a rail engineer. What's he doing looking at a ferry?
Mm-hmm.
In 1850... he created the very first roll-on, roll-off train ferry.
Give me a minute to get my head around that. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds very cool.
The world's first.
Huh.
Now, I didn't look into it too much, but it's pretty much exactly what it sounds like. A train can roll onto the ferry, and the ferry has tracks, like, through its belly.
Yeah.
The ferry crosses the water with the train, and then the train rolls off.
Damn.
And joins the tracks on land again.
That's wild.
And in theory, I think it could go both ways.
Oh, that would make sense.
I believe. But again, I didn't look into this too much, but he did this for the first time. This was the world's first roll-on, roll-off train ferry.
That's very cool.
Isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
In 1850.
I love that.
He's a smart cookie.
Mm. A shame someone, we should build a bridge instead. Like, oh, but I've just invented the ferry. But my ferry. It's upsetting. What was his name again?
Thomas Bush.
It was the Bush Ferry. It's going to be huge.
His surname is Bouch.
Bouch. Huh.
So I may be pronouncing it wrong. I apologise.
You may be Bouch-ering it.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Maybe. I'm sorry.
Bouch-ering it.
But now we're in the 1850s. We have about 30 years to go.
Mm.
Two railway companies, the Scottish North British Railway, which was the one that had been Edinburgh Northern. Mm-hmm. That was the one that Thomas Bush was the manager of.
Yep.
It's now called Scottish North British Railways.
Scottish North British. Yep.
And the second one was Caledonian Railways.
Oh.
Now, they were the two big players in the Scottish rail game.
Mm-hmm.
They were each other's biggest rival, and both companies appreciated there was a lot of money to be made in who owned as much of the rail as possible. Who controlled the major links.
That makes sense.
And the major routes. They knew that person would make a lot more money. Mm-hmm. And both companies were eyeing up the River Tay at this point. The River Tay and the Firth of Tay. The Tay, the Firth kind of turns into a river.
Yeah, I was wondering what a firth is.
Or vice versa. It's kind of, it's difficult to explain. I'm not going to try because I'm going to sound stupid.
No. Is it the kind of the bit near the entrance?
I'm not going to explain because I'll sound stupid. I have provided you with a visual aid. That is the best I can do.
Yes.
All I know is that it's basically where a river leads to the coast.
Yep. Firth Ridley. Pretty good, right?
If anyone would like a husband, please come collect at 123 Internet
Stop.
Avenue.
Stop selling me in the internet.
It's okay. It's fine if you dox yourself. Anyway, like I was saying, both companies were eyeing up the River Tay and the Firth of Tay.
Yes.
Which is the one that runs south of Dundee.
Yes.
Because both of these companies knew that whoever managed to cross the Tay with rail first would make a buttload of money.
Yeah.
Because they could expand their routes, they could expand their company. It's a big deal.
And they could charge everyone else who wants to use it.
Exactly.
That's pretty good.
It's like Monopoly, really.
Yeah.
That's kind of how I imagine it. It's like buying up the Monopoly board. Mm-hmm. In 1854, Bush, who remember is the manager of Scottish North British Railway, he submitted plans to his bosses that he had drawn up for two bridges that he wanted to build.
Mm.
One of them crossing the Tay and the other one crossing the Forth.
Shit.
So he had plans. He knew how he wanted to do it. Mm-hmm. He's proposed, this is how we'll get it done. We can do it. It seems like a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
Like, go big or go home. They know that this is a thing that will bring them lots of money. So he's gone out and done the work.
Yep. Big ass bridge. I like it.
Yeah. But he was basically laughed out of the office. They told him that, quote, this was the most insane idea ever to be propounded.
And, oh, it's just a shame because he proves them wrong, sort of.
Yeah. If you know where the story is going, he's kind of right, and they were kind of right.
I'll show you. Oh, you shouldn't have let me do that.
But, you know, it was quite a harsh thing to say. That would be difficult to bounce back from.
Yeah, absolutely.
That you feel like you've had this idea and you've developed it, but someone just laughs fully in your face when you put it forward.
Yeah. When he's sitting there going, I brought you train boats. That was me.
From the man who brought you the train boat comes the train bridge. However, Bush ended up with the last laugh.
Mm-hmm.
Because in 1870, so a wee bit ahead, 16 years.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, it's only Westminster at this time. It's not the Scottish Parliament.
Of course, yep.
Parliament passed a bill which gave him permission to build a bridge over the Tay.
Oh, shit.
Which is a win. He was going to be the one to design and build it.
Yeah. It's crazy he had to go like all the way to Westminster.
Mm-hmm. It was a long fight from what I read. Took a long time.
Yeah. That was 16 years is a long time.
Yeah. And Bush had a lot of responsibility when it came to this bridge. He was responsible for its design, its construction, and its maintenance.
That's intense.
It was his project.
Yeah. Which is great and everything, but it's also almost like a slopey shoulders. Okay, we'll let this happen, but it's on you. We are taking nothing to do with it.
It's a lot to take on.
Yeah.
Whoo.
Fuck. Best of luck.
Good luck, Bush. It's 1871.
Okay.
8 years to go. The contractors who were given the Tay Rail Bridge project were given it in 1871. They won the contract. They say they'll have it built in 3 years. And it'll cost £217,000.
Nice.
Now, you're going to be proud of me because I tried to do some maths.
Cool, you.
Now, I believe that £100 in 1871 would be worth £12,550 today.
That's intense.
I have no idea if this is correct.
There's an online tool you can use.
I tried. I have no idea if that's correct because I have no way to verify.
Yeah.
So the estimate that they gave for giving the bridge built would be £27,233,500 today.
27. Yep, that seems like a lot, but it's a big bridge, so fair enough.
It's no small amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
But it's important to understand how major this project was going to be, which is why I kind of wanted to give you the figure to put you in mind of the scale that this was taking. The Tay Rail Bridge was going to be the biggest engineering project in the country.
I believe it.
It was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
The part of the Tay that they were trying to cross with the bridge was about 1.5 miles wide. It's really close to Dundee.
1.5 miles of bridge.
Mm-hmm. Well, the bridge itself was going to be 2 miles long.
Oh, of course. Yep, that makes sense.
Which was going to make the Tay Bridge the longest in the world.
Damn.
At the time it was being built.
That's wild.
Mm-hmm. The longest bridge in the world.
Longest bridge in the world.
In Scotland.
Yeah, in Scotland.
It's difficult to imagine things like that now.
Yeah, it is, because it wouldn't seem worth it.
I just can't imagine it being in Scotland.
No. I wonder how long the current longest bridge in the world is.
Well, Kieran.
Oh.
I actually looked into it, and I have quite a lot of information for you, sir.
That's nice. I was wondering.
I'm not getting caught out with this shit again.
Yeah.
I figured you would ask. The longest bridge is the Danyang Kunshan Grand Bridge in China.
It's easy for you to say.
No, it isn't. It's part of the Beijing-Shanghai high-speed railway.
Okay.
And it was only finished in 2010.
Mm.
It's not that long ago. From the list that I looked at of all the longest bridges, most of them are in China, Taiwan, and Japan.
Interesting.
A couple further down the list are in Louisiana in the States. But most of them are in China.
It's quite big.
The longest bridge in Europe is in Portugal.
Oh.
And it's 17 kilometres long.
Oh.
Which is 10.5 miles.
Yeah, that's hefty.
Now, the Danyang Kunshan Bridge is 164 kilometres long.
What?
Almost 102 miles.
What? How? How can that even... Oh, my... days.
Mm-hmm.
That is mental. Mental.
Isn't that wild?
That is wild. I remember a little while ago in the news, they were floating an idea of building a bridge to France and to Ireland.
Oh yeah, because Boris Johnson's a twat.
I think it was before Boris Johnson.
He was the one who brought the idea forward.
Oh, was he? Oh, yes. Was it when he was mayor?
Because it was part of Brexit. Oh, yes, we'll have a bridge over to Northern Ireland. I will, you fuck.
Mm, yeah, fuck. I think it was when they were, before they built the Channel Tunnel to France, they wondered about building a big-ass bridge instead.
Well, lately, it was Johnson who brought forward the idea of building a bridge to Ireland.
That makes sense. That does make...
Because he's an idiot.
Yeah. Him, that he did it, not building the bridge makes sense. But yeah, I just thought that's way too far to build a bridge. Like, how could that even be possible? But there you go.
Well, bear in mind, I don't think that this bridge is over water for all of it.
Mm.
But it is still a bridge.
Interesting.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Now, it's over 100 miles long. It cost $8.5 billion to build.
Oh.
And the train on it runs at 350 kilometres an hour.
Fuck.
That's 217 miles per hour. That's the top speed.
I can't imagine these high-speed rails.
217 miles an hour.
That's insane. I wonder how many stops it has. A bunch.
I'm not sure.
Just every mile, just accelerating and decelerating really rapidly. Like a roller coaster.
Mm-hmm. But this is me trying to make trains fun.
I'm having fun.
I hope it's paying off.
Yeah. For all you trainiacs out there.
Trainiacs. Anyway, back to the Tay Bridge.
Mm-hmm.
It was set to be 2 miles long.
Oh, easy. Piece of piss.
Which would make it the longest bridge in the world at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But now you have an idea of how much things have changed.
Yeah.
You know, in China, they're like, oh, well, our longest is 102. Sort it out.
Get real.
Mm-hmm.
Damn, that's... I'm trying to think how far that would take you. That would take you well further than Glasgow to Edinburgh. Because Glasgow to Edinburgh is like 50 miles-ish, I think.
For a country as small as Scotland, it's almost inconceivable.
Yeah. So it would take you from, just about from Inverness to Perth, maybe.
It's double the length of Inverness to Liverpool.
Yeah.
Almost.
That's really bizarre.
on one bridge.
Yeah. And presumably it's largely straight. Oh, can't even imagine.
No.
Bananas.
So we're going to talk about how the bridge was built.
Yes. I'm oddly excited.
Really?
Yeah.
I was so worried that you were going to find this dull.
No.
I've had big nerves about this episode. I wanted to do it properly. Mm-hmm. So I didn't want to skip over all the bridge and train stuff since it's core to the story.
Well, it's pretty crucial, isn't it?
But I was worried it was going to be dull.
No, I'm having a great time.
Well, Kieran, if you refer to the email I sent you the photos, I think it's the first photo. In fact, you give it here and I'll find the right one so it doesn't spoiler it for you.
Spoilies.
And like I said, these photos will hopefully be wherever we are so that you can look at these too if you're interested.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm going to show you now is a picture of the completed bridge.
Hmm.
Okay. So this first one is of the bridge.
That is a big-ass bridge, isn't it?
And that's from the south looking north. So looking towards Dundee.
Nice, nice.
Okay.
Yep, I like it.
I'm going to show you another one.
Look at all the smoke coming out.
Mm-hmm.
Jeez, oh, you can see the pillars of industry, can't you?
From Dundee, yeah, the big chimneys. Very smoggy.
Mm-hmm.
Now this next one, if you just stay on this photo, that would be useful. Or actually, there is another one, which I will show you. I will show you these at the right moment. If you stay on this one for now,
okay,
this would be useful because it will help explain what I mean when I'm talking about the bridge.
Okay, okay.
All right.
Is this the same bridge?
Yes.
Over the north, yep.
I think, I hope.
Yeah.
I hope, it better be.
It looked straight, but there's a huge big curve in it.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool.
But this is from the north looking south.
Mm.
So this is from the Dundee side. So Boucher's going to be using a lot of metal to build this bridge.
Yeah.
Which is a major understatement, I know. But I don't have other ways of saying these things. Mm. The bridge was made up of lots of different spans, so different sections. And there was a single track in each direction on the bridge. So two tracks total.
Yep.
All right. Not a lot of space on the bridge because of this.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was only the two tracks.
Yep, that makes sense.
Which you can kind of see in, mm-hmm. in one of the photos. There were 85 spans total. So that they're like big lengths of bridge.
Yeah, each big section.
Mm-hmm. 85. 72 of them were supported by girders that were below the train track. So the bulk of the support was underneath the tracks.
Mm-hmm.
But what made the bridge more unusual is that there were 13 spans that weren't built this way. Now, if you look at, I suppose, both of them, you can see it in both of those photos. These 13 spans were different. They were in the middle.
Yeah.
The girders that were supporting the track were above it.
It looks like the middle chunk of the bridge is just upside down.
Yes, that's exactly what it looks like. The girders are above, not below. Now, if you give me your phone.
I just zoomed in. Whoop.
There's a photo that better illustrates what I mean.
If you'd all hand in your phones, those of you who are listening.
Just give it here, Alpha. I just don't want you to spoiler what I'm going to talk about later by looking at the other photos. This is it.
Hmm.
So basically, in this section, these 13 spans, the train would run through a mini tunnel of metal girders.
Yeah.
Instead of on top of them.
Yep, I think that makes sense.
That makes sense. And the reason that they did this was because they had to meet guidelines for clearance under the bridge.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So that ships, boats could all pass under it safely with their tall masts.
Well, because it looks really weird because the bridge is entirely flat.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's raised, if you haven't looked at the photo, it's raised up at the end and then is one height all the way over. It's not arched, which is how I would have expected it to be. To be tall enough to get everybody underneath it.
Mm-hmm. Well, they just did it one level, but in this section, which is kind of in the middle of this bit of the T, they had to have the bottom of the bridge at 88 feet of clearance between that and the high water mark.
Mm.
So that ships could pass under it safely on their way to Dundee or Perth.
That makes sense.
And these ships had big tall masts at the time, so they needed this height. So that was how they got around the issue of making sure ships could pass underneath it at that point.
I like it.
Does that make sense so far?
I think so.
They put the girders on top of the track instead of below.
Yeah. So it's almost like that section's hung from the girders instead of on top of the girders. Maybe.
No, the opposite. The girders are above the track.
Yeah, so the track's like...
Oh, I think meant the girder... Never mind. We're making it confusing. That's just the important bit. This middle section, the girders are above. And mm-hmm. This section's referred to as the high girders.
That makes sense.
So that's how I'll refer to them. Mm-hmm. Now, a single one of these spans... Remember, there's 85 of them.
Mm-hmm.
A single one of these spans weighed about 230 tons.
That's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of weight.
Mm-hmm. And the track itself and the girders and everything, they were built on these huge columns that were underneath. And these columns were built on like piers that were sunk into the water to support the bridge.
I've always wondered how you build up out of the water.
Now that's a very basic description. Yeah. There's a lot of detail out there about how they did this and the process they used and the materials. If that's your game, I'll have all the links for you. But there was a lot I didn't understand, so I don't want to just say the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm.
But from what I could see, they just sunk piers into the water or built them like on the bottom where they could reach.
Yeah.
And then the bridge was built on these piers.
Very cool.
Now, laying these piers could be quite dangerous. Because there were lots of steps, there was lots of metal columns, they had to sink things and they had to extract water to build and then put the water back, all kinds of stuff. In 1875, 6 workers were killed after an accident in this process, which basically meant that they were rushed with a whole load of water and mud.
Ooh.
And it killed them.
That's nasty.
Mm-hmm. A really awful, awful way to go.
Oh.
And one of the important things to note about these columns and the piers that they were on is that a lot of metal was used, particularly for the piers. There wasn't a lot of stone or brick, which is what Bush had originally planned in his design, but he changed it because he wasn't able to lay the stone and the brick like he wanted to.
Interesting.
There was a lot of sand and gravel and things that wasn't possible, so they ended up using more metal. The piers that were closer to the edges of the Firth, closer to shore, they were brick because they were easier to get to. But as they got deeper into the water, they started using metal ones instead because they were easier to install.
Well, because you could, in theory, or maybe not, but just make it and then sink it.
That's what they did.
If it was made of metal.
That's what they did.
Easier than you could if it was made of brick and stone.
Yes. At its deepest point, I think the Firth of Tay is about 80 feet deep.
That's pretty deep.
So it's difficult. But it meant, because these deeper foundations were made of metal, these deeper foundations were not as stable. In the middle of the water.
It's not really what you want.
No. Another important design change that Bush made during the construction, the building of the bridge, was reducing the number of spans that would be used. He had originally planned for there to be more than 85, but he had to reduce it with, you know, having to change the piers and yada yada. It meant that the fewer spans that were left had to be made longer than he had originally intended, which again makes them less stable, because it's more stable if you have more smaller pieces than fewer longer pieces.
That makes sense, because you'd have more legs, basically.
Yeah. And each span was 245 feet long. I know it's difficult to imagine, but this is just to give you an idea.
A flavour.
Yes.
Well, I can look at the picture and know how long that is.
Yes. So, you know, he was making changes as they went, which he didn't intend. Which, you know, it happens with building that you have to make changes because things don't go the way you plan. And while everyone was really excited that the bridge was going to be built, like everyone thought it was a great idea, it was going to make things so much easier. When the details of Bush's design started getting out and people started finding out about it, they didn't think it was designed well. And there was a lot of concern that it wasn't going to be stable from what they had heard of the design.
Interesting. Doubts. It's hard to imagine this one person having the whole thing in his head. I know he wrote it down, he delegated, I'm sure he got help with calculations and things. But for him to lead the whole process... He has to understand the entire thing and to hold that in his head at once. And just that blows my mind.
On top of using new technology.
That's true as well, yeah. So then in your head, when something changes, you know, okay, we'll use 85 instead of 130 or whatever it is, then he has to change everything in his brain to fit the new piece of information,
mm-hmm.
which is still what people will have to do. The time doesn't really matter. It's just that blows my mind.
It's a real talent.
Yeah. But when you've been developing it for 16 years between coming up with the idea and it getting approved, there's a lot of time to think about it.
Mm-hmm. To then have to change it.
Yeah. Crazy.
So now we're in 1877. 2 years to go.
Hmm.
Progress has been slower than was promised, but the Tay Bridge is slowly going up by this point. It's been in construction for 6 years by 1877, when Classic. It was supposed to be finished in three.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, that's pretty common on any construction job, I feel like.
Pretty standard, yeah.
It never goes to plan. And a big reason for the delay was the amount of changes that had to be made to the design.
Yeah.
Because they couldn't carry on building when everything had to be changed.
Mm.
So that was unforeseen. The changes were made. The bridge is going up. In February of that year, 1877... the weather was particularly bad.
Mm.
Very windy.
It's not what you want.
This was happening at the point that the high girders were being lifted and placed onto the bridge.
Definitely not what you want.
So that section I was talking about, the metal tunnel, where the girders are higher than the rest, this is what they were installing.
Mm.
A strong gale blasted the bridge, and it actually blew some of the high girders off the bridge, along with some of the workers' shacks which had been built in them while they were constructing the bridge.
Mm.
Now, one worker was killed in this accident, but they managed to fix everything afterwards. Everything was put back into place, and it was like nothing happened.
I was thinking, well, it's windy because it's not connected at the end. Like, it's one thing being windy if it's connected at both ends, but if you've just got a point that's out in the middle, it's gonna catch the wind, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Ew.
A few months later, in September 1877,
mm-hmm.
the Tay Rail Bridge was crossed for the very first time.
Ooh.
So it's not that one point anymore. It's a complete route.
Yep,
you can
made
go
it.
From one side to the other.
Hooray!
Now, the directors of the railway company, Scottish and North British Rail,
mm-hmm.
they were given the honour of crossing the bridge for the first time. And I'm sure they were very pleased because this was going to make them a hell of a lot of money. Thrilled.
Naturally.
February 1878.
Mm.
22 months to go. A man called Major General Hutchinson was the chief inspecting officer for railways across the board, not just one railway company. He was the chief inspector for them all.
Damn.
He was called to inspect the Tay Bridge. That was his job. And the bridge was basically ready to be opened, so now was the time for all of the testing to ensure that it was safe.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that he was diligent in his work, inspecting the bridge. He spent 3 days there, inspecting every part in the way that he knew how.
Yeah, but just kicking tires, standing in the middle, like grabbing both sides and rocking it, seeing how stable it is.
Well, one of the things that's available are the records of his inspection.
Oh, yeah?
Mm-hmm. They Very still cool. exist. They're in archives. You can access them online.
Huh.
That's one of the things that I couldn't access with my brain. But it does exist. It is out there.
I imagine it's very technical.
Yes. And it's old-timey language.
Oh, of course. Yeah, just for extra.
So it's both. But I did have a look. I tried.
Hmm.
There's a couple of important details I got from it. But on the whole, I just couldn't. I feel like I failed this episode.
Failed us.
I need an engineer.
Help. We need an engineer. I'm only a physicist. I'm all theoretical.
We should have asked Struan.
Could have asked Struan. My brother's an engineer.
No, but he does boats.
Mm.
It's probably not the same. The ships, not boats.
Not boats. He does big
I'll
ships.
Get a slap on the wrist if I call that a boat.
He just knows about going under bridges, except his ships are too big to go under bridges.
Hutchinson was doing all of his tests.
Mm.
And one of the tests that he did, or like a series of tests, was to have different types and different loads of engines and trains run over the bridge
mm-hmm.
to just see how it responded and to check everything. And he claimed that the vibrations caused by all these different engines weren't an issue on the bridge. That's something they had to check so that everything remained stable mm-hmm. as, you know, it moved around. But crucially, Hutchinson did not or could not test wind pressure and how that would impact the bridge.
Interesting.
However, in his notes from the inspection, he wrote that he wanted to do it. He just didn't.
Interesting. I wonder why, if he didn't have instrumentation or...
It's unclear. I'm not sure why this didn't happen. It's just in his notes that his intention was to check the wind pressure. It didn't happen.
Mm.
The bridge was opened to rail traffic that same month.
Mm.
And the official opening of the bridge happened in May 1878.
Mm.
In total, it cost £300,000 to build. About £37.5 million today.
Oh. So that's, what was the original quote? 200 and something?
The original quote was £217,000.
Mm.
And it cost £300,000 in the end.
I thought it would go a lot more over budget.
Mm-hmm.
Still a lot of money though.
So now we're in June 1878.
Oh man, I'm getting tense.
18 months to go.
Mm.
The bridge was open to passenger traffic for the first time in June. Before that, it was just like freight trains.
Mm.
And then passengers were allowed to cross. And over the first year of the bridge being open, the directors of the rail company were laughing all the way to the bank. Because it changed everything. People and business owners in Dundee and Fife noticed an upturn in sales and profits.
Oh, wow.
Because more people were travelling between there and Edinburgh than had before.
That makes sense.
Or other places, but Edinburgh was the main one.
Yeah.
And passenger numbers between those two places doubled after the bridge was built. So you didn't have to go around the long way as much anymore.
Well, and you can just nip over. And it's new and it's a novelty. Mm-hmm. Like, of course you're going to... Because I would have thought, had everything been fine, the numbers would have doubled, but then kind of drifted away again as the novelty wore off before they started increasing up again.
Well, journeys were a lot easier than they had been.
Yeah.
More people were travelling this route than ever.
Mm-hmm.
I think I remember seeing that the company, there was a 40% increase in freight traffic and passenger numbers doubled.
That's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of use.
Right. So they were thrilled.
Oh, yeah.
They were making a fortune. June 1879. 6 months to go.
Oh.
In June, Queen Victoria herself was a passenger in a train that crossed the Tay Bridge. Now, I know that probably wouldn't be as big a deal now if Queenie crossed a bridge in a train. But this was Queen Victoria.
Mm.
It's a different time. The royals were just seen differently, much more reverently than now. It was a huge moment. It was a huge moment for the people who had built the bridge. A huge moment for the people of Dundee, because it's a subject of pride. That the Queen has come across the bridge, the longest bridge in the world, that's built outside Dundee.
It's pretty cool.
It's major. And this was a huge moment for Thomas Bouche, because he was knighted for building the Tay Bridge by Queen Victoria that same month, just after she had gone on the bridge.
Uh-huh.
He was knighted, a significant reward for all his hard work.
Absolutely.
He was recognised for his brilliance and his commitment to progress, because this is another step forward for industry and modernisation.
Absolutely.
They've crossed the Tay.
Well deserved, all things accounted for up till then.
Now remember, this was also just the beginning for Bouche, because he was scheduled to design and build the fourth bridge too, remember?
Oh yeah. And he must be, in his 40s, early 40s by now?
He is 58.
Oh. Okay.
At this point. So life is good.
I know, eh? You've been knighted, the Queen went on your bridge, everyone's stoked on you.
Mm-hmm. Everyone thinks you're great, you're about to build another major bridge.
Mm.
As part of the same network for the same company, it's going really well. But now we've reached the 28th of December, 1879. Our countdown that we set at the top of the episode is nearly over. If you want to unclench, now's the time. Just ease the jaw, just relax the jaw.
I'm going to stay clenched. I'm going to stay dead!
We're at 1:15 p.m. 6 hours to go. A man called Captain Wright was in charge of a ferry that crossed the Tay. Remember I said they had the ferry crossings before the bridge. He's in charge of one of the ferries. And when he crossed the water that afternoon, a normal crossing, he noticed that the weather was good. Nothing to report, nothing of note. Pretty sure captains keep logs of things like that.
Yep.
Later at 4:15, another crossing, he noticed the same thing. The weather was fine. His crossing went without a hitch. There was just a bit of wind that hadn't been there that morning. However, by 5:15 p.m., we're at 2 hours to go, and things are very different.
Oh, wow.
Captain Wright remembered that a gale had picked up, and it was coming in from the west.
Mm.
He noted that.
Straight in from the sea.
Mm-hmm. Just after 6 p.m., about an hour to go. No, if it's coming from the west, then it's heading out to sea.
Oh, yeah, I always do that.
It's coming overland. Just after 6 p.m., about an hour to go. A train arrived at Dundee Station on the northern side of the bridge. And the passengers who stepped off spoke of the terrible crossing that they just had over the Tay. They'd come from Newport, which was on the other side from Dundee. And they spoke about how hard the wind had been hitting the side of the carriages. It was coming and hitting the bridge and the train at a right angle.
So oh, yeah.
Right on the side.
Mm-hmm.
It was strong enough that it was making their carriages rock from side to side.
Whoa, terrifying.
And at one point, some of them reported that they had seen sparks coming from the wheels.
That's not good.
No. Just after 7 p.m., 15 minutes to go. A train sat at Wormit Station, which was on the southern side of the Tay and the bridge. The passengers stepped on board. They had their tickets checked. They took their seats. Now, some of them were heading home to Dundee after being away over Christmas and New Year, because it's the 28th of December. Some of them were heading home just after being away for the weekend. It was a Sunday evening. The weekend was over. Work would be starting the next morning, Monday morning. Some of them were just commuting to and from work. So this is 7 p.m. The doors of the train were closed. The whistle blew. And the train left Wormit Station with reportedly 56 passengers on board, along with several train staff. Now, it's impossible to be sure how many people were on this train. 56 tickets were checked at St. Fort Station, which was the last station before the bridge. But these were people who were going to Dundee. These tickets. People had different tickets. People had season tickets for the train that weren't logged in the same way. If they were heading for different destinations past Dundee, they weren't checked and logged. So it's really difficult to track how many people exactly were on the train. From what I've found, people have been able to prove that 59 people were on the train total. So I'm going with 59. That's what they've been able to prove. Anything other than that is speculation. Now we've reached 7:15 p.m. on Sunday, the 28th of December, 1879, and our countdown is over. The train set out onto the bridge and into the dark, and the staff at the station reported later how they watched the lights of the train disappear. The gale that Captain Wright had noticed was now battering the bridge at that right angle that I told you about. From the west. It was reportedly a Beaufort Force 10 or 11 gale. Now, I assume you have the context to know what that means.
I do.
We're going to get into it. But this was blowing down the length of the Firth and hitting the bridge.
Mentally strong winds.
Yeah. I had a rough idea, so I looked into it a bit more. So if you have no idea what I'm talking about, please don't worry. I'm about to explain. But Kieran is very wide-eyed right now. So I know he knows what I'm talking about. But I'll get into it. The Beaufort scale, I think is how you say it. B-E-A-U-F-O-R-T. Is the scale that the Met Office use. So the Met Office are the people who track the weather in the UK. They use it to measure how strong wind is, and they base it on how it affects the sea or the water. So if you are working at sea, if you are on the sea, you pay attention to the Beaufort scale. That tells you how strong a storm is.
Yep.
Am I right?
Yep.
0 to 5 on this scale is fairly mild. 0 to 5 is anything up to a fresh breeze. That's how they describe it. And bodies of water that are affected by anything 0 to 5 might have anything up to moderate waves, according to the official scale. This is not my vocabulary. 6 to 9 on the scale would be a strong breeze to a strong gale. and waves would be rough and high. 10 to 11 on the Beaufort scale are described like this: storm, violent storm, and very high waves. 12 is the only number higher on this scale, and you use a 12 when you are describing a hurricane with, quote, phenomenal waves. At 10 or 11 on the scale, you'll find wind speeds between 55 and 72 miles per hour.
That's fast.
Which is 48 to 63 knots, if you're being technical, because that's the term you use at sea.
Yep.
But I can't grasp knots. I'm not familiar with that system, mm-hmm. So I thought miles per hour would be helpful.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how are you feeling hearing that the bridge is subject to a 10 or 11 gale?
Tense. Frightened.
What do you know of this?
I know that is incredibly windy. I don't think I've ever been on the sea above like a 5. I don't even think at a 5. Because I've sailed and stuff when I was younger.
Kieran is very familiar with the water and sailing.
Yep. I am part fish.
He is part fish. Which also means you're part cannibal.
Oh, no.
Just a point of contention.
Just throwing it out there. Bring cannibals into this.
Hashtag expose Kieran.
Kieran the cannibal. Yeah, that's some crazy weather. That's stay in your house weather. Mm-hmm. Like you're certainly not going out in the boat. And you certainly shouldn't be going on a bridge.
Mm-hmm. Now, I actually went the extra mile this week.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided to ask your dad.
My dad, not the reader's dads.
No, I'm afraid I didn't reach out to all of your dads. I'm sorry. Tell them I say hi, but I haven't spoken to them. No, I reached out to Kieran's dad this week.
Yep.
Just to get his point of view, because he was a fisherman for a long time. He's lived on the sea almost his entire life. Mm-hmm. He knows it extremely well. I wanted to know what he thought about a 10 or 11 gale, basically. I wanted to know if he knew what it would be like. And not only was he able to tell me what it would be like, he told me about being out on a boat during a 10 or 11 gale.
I don't know if I want to hear the story.
So I'll tell you what he told me.
Please do.
And I'm hoping if you're listening to this, this will just give you an idea of what the conditions were really like on the 28th of December. I feel like this will help you understand how this could have happened. Mm-hmm. Or at least I hope it's helpful. I asked your dad if he had ever experienced a 10 or 11 gale. And this is what he told me. I'm hoping you will interject with some details to explain.
I can try.
At points. He said, I have, but in inshore waters, in Loch Broom during the Klondike. So do you want to explain the Klondike?
I can. The Klondike was a period in the 80s when the Klondikers, which were a Russian factory ship, were fishing in Scotland. And they were great big herring fishers, I think. They basically scooped up all the fish and then processed them on board and took them back to Russia and other places. So it was all these giant kind of big factory ships were in and around Loch Broom, which is at Ullapool. And that's quite a sheltered bay, really. Kind of like in the Firth and stuff, except it's even smaller. So a force 10 would still be crazy, but there's quite a lot of like hills and stuff around. So it wouldn't be the full force of being like in the middle of the ocean.
Well, here's what he had to say about this gale in this sheltered bay surrounded by giant hills.
Mm.
The wind was blowing over 130 miles per hour.
Oh my days.
The local boats either hung by the stern from the pier or they ran ashore. Several pursers broke anchor and went ashore too. A Romanian factory ship got blown through a fish farm and then blown ashore.
That's not good, is it?
Kieran looks like he's just peed his pants.
Yeah. Why was he... How could you even be at sea in that? I don't even know.
You're going to have to ask him. This is just what he told me.
He turned to a kite.
He went on. Shore Street, that's the front street on the shore in Ullapool, as you would expect. Shore Street was flooded, and the salmon from the farm were washed ashore. I was stuck punching up and down the loch on our 50-foot fishing boat, Windsor, with nowhere to anchor and no space at the pier.
Mm.
That was a long night.
Oh.
He also said, I've been out in a severe gale 9 in open water, and that was bloody scary too.
I can imagine. Oh.
Now, what was funny, to kind of lift the mood, was he was talking about how all the salmon from the fish farm got washed ashore in Ullapool, And he was really mad that he was stuck on the boat because everyone in Ullapool were taking their wheelbarrows down to Shore Street and whisking away the salmon.
That I've heard, yeah.
He called it Ullapool's version of whiskey galore.
Yeah.
And we might do a mini episode on whiskey galore.
That'd be fun.
If you're interested in hearing more. Mm-hmm. It's a good story. Mm-hmm. I would look it up. Now, I asked him to tell me a bit more about what the wind and the waves would be like, what they were like when he was out in it, to get an idea of what the tea would be like. And he said, when the Romanian went ashore, the big ship, the harbour master asked me to go and see. I tried to get through the narrows, but couldn't. So do you want to explain what he means by that?
If you go up Lochbroom, there's the narrows, where the water narrows, because there's two kind of like jutting bits of land, and you kind of have to zigzag through them slightly. You have to do it fairly carefully if you're in a big boat, because it gets a lot shallower there. So you have to stick to the middle, kind of like going under the bridge, which would be quite difficult if it was 130 mile an hour winds.
Mm-hmm. So he couldn't get through.
Yeah.
This is where you might want to clench, Kieran.
Mm.
The boat was burying completely underwater, and the waves were covering the wheelhouse. I got halfway and she stopped dead, then started going backwards.
Oh, no.
That was probably the worst. Windsor went back, then sideways, and rolled so far I thought I was dead. She lay on her side, and I just shut my eyes.
Boat.
And he finished off answering my question by saying, I love boats because they've always saved me.
Well, that's true.
I can't even begin to imagine what that would feel like.
Yeah.
He said that he's been overboard twice, he's been sunk once, but this night was the one that he remembers. This was the scariest.
Yeah. Oh, God, I can't even.
Yeah.
Going backwards as well.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's because it was so buoyant, so it like ploughed in forwards and then just got shot backwards.
Not sure.
Then with the wind. But.
So I wanted to talk to him about that because this is what conditions were like on the Tay that night.
Mm.
It was this level of storm. So this is what it could do to a boat.
Yep.
And they're, I suppose, kind of comparable because Lochbroom is in open water in the same way that the Tay is in open water.
Mm-hmm.
It's got land on either side of it kind of thing.
Mm.
Okay. It was winds like this that were hitting the Tay Bridge at that right angle. And a train had just gone out onto the bridge.
Mm.
As the train disappeared into the dark, there were a lot of people who lived on either side on the shore that could see the bridge from their homes. People at the station could see the bridge. People in Wormit, which was a village on the banks of the Tay. That's where the station was, where the trains just left. I think people in Dundee could also see the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
Just like from their kitchen windows and stuff like that, from their gardens. Several people reported seeing a bright flash on the bridge at 7:15, which was the exact time, because they knew how long it would take a train to go over the bridge.
Well, that makes sense.
This was the exact time that the train would have entered the high girder section of the bridge when this flash went off, the metal tunnel portion that I talked about earlier. The people on the Wormit side, so the south side, of the bridge, tried to send a message to the signal cabin on the north side of the bridge, but the message wouldn't go. Communication had been lost between both sides of the bridge, and the people who were stuck at the station had no idea what the flash was. They couldn't see anything, but they knew it couldn't be anything good. But even they couldn't have guessed what had actually happened. Because remember, it'd be pitch black.
Yeah.
Not everything would be lit in the same way.
No. And if there's that wind, there's probably rain as well.
Exactly. Over on the Dundee side, 7:19 p.m. came and went, with no sign of the train. Now, it was supposed to pass by them at 7:19 p.m. exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how they knew where the train would be on the bridge. Everything was timed. They knew. Yep. So they knew something had gone wrong, but they had no idea where the train was or what could have happened. Now, their first response was to message the Wormit side of the bridge, but that was when they realised the communication lines were gone. And like, even at this point, I don't think they would have assumed the bridge had collapsed.
Why would you?
Your first thought would probably be that the telegraph lines are down.
Yeah.
Because it's really windy and really wild. That's what you would think. But they had to go and figure out what was going on.
Mm.
So a man called James Roberts, who worked at the station and with the tracks and everything. He was chosen to go out onto the bridge to find out what had happened.
Oh, a bit reluctantly.
I cannot imagine being that man.
I know.
I can think of few worse jobs than that.
Yeah, being the short straw.
Because it's still windy.
You get blown off.
So he had to walk out onto the bridge in this gale. And reportedly at times he had to crawl along this bridge because he could not stand up.
Mm. I would believe it.
And he's just out in the middle of the Tay in almost pitch black. Now, he managed to make it to where the low girders gave way to the high girders, but James wasn't able to go any further. And this is because the entire high girder section of the bridge was gone.
The whole thing. Oh, fuck.
The entire middle section of the Tay Bridge had fallen into the water below, taking the train with it. So it's 13 spans, each one is 245 feet, which is 3,185 feet of bridge, 970 metres. Now, I do have a photo I'd like to show you at this point to show you what James saw. Actually, I have two. Bear with me, I'm sorry.
Quite all right.
So there's two. And I suppose you could just look at all the photos now that you know what happens. But that's the first one.
Jesus.
And if you look through the photos, you can look at all the ones I've sent you now. It's incredibly eerie to look at because the bottom of the columns that support the bridge, the bits that are made of stronger stuff, they largely survived. They're still in the water. But the metal columns and the entire track, girders, everything on top is completely gone. There's just a whole section out in the middle of the bridge that just looks like it's been lifted out.
It looks unfinished. Mm-hmm. Or like they've removed a section to repair it and put it back in.
Because there's a whole piece that just isn't there anymore. Just
taking a Lego brick out.
Mm-hmm. So that's what happened. And I think I've put in another photo of, I think it was taken the next morning, and you can see the high girder section just lying in the water.
Oh man, that's very eerie.
Mm-hmm. So when the train workers realised what happened, like James Roberts made it back.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't get blown off, thankfully. A telegram was sent to North British Railway's engineer near Edinburgh. This is telegrams, it's 1879.
Mm-hmm.
And it read, "Terrible accident on bridge, one or more high girders blown down. I'm not sure as to the safety of last train down from Edinburgh. Will advise further as soon as can be obtained." So they had no idea what happened. They just knew that the bridge had collapsed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the shock that not just Scottish society, British society felt at the Tay Bridge collapse cannot be underestimated. Everyone was horrified.
Yeah.
As people would be now. Because you'd never imagine that it's actually going to happen.
No, absolutely not. Not when it's the peak of engineering and everything.
This was a great achievement. Mm-hmm. This was a mark of modernity, and it collapsed with people on the bridge. Now, I'm not sure exactly when the rescue operation started, because I couldn't find whether the boats had gone out that night or not. Because if it's that dangerous, they're not going to be able to.
Yeah, I doubt they would have had to wait till it passed.
Well, exactly. Or at least till, morning.
Yeah.
Because you can't see. Mm-hmm. There's wreckage in the water. You could be endangering more life.
Well, that's just it. You take a boat out and then crash into the fallen bit of bridge.
Exactly. Ooh. So I'm not sure when it actually started. What I do know is that there was a rescue operation, but there were no survivors.
I didn't think there would be.
None. Which is awful. It's really, really heavy. On the 29th of December, so this is the day after, the first of the victims were recovered from the water.
Oh.
And over the next few days, a lot of the victims would be found as they washed up, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
That's what happens. Sometimes it takes a couple of days if someone's drowned until you find them.
Yeah.
However, from what I got differing information, but only 46 of the 59 people known to be on board were ever found. Some of them were never recovered.
Yeah.
And there's lots of stories and details about some of the victims who were on the train. But the overwhelming thing about all of them is that they were startlingly normal and were doing things that people would be doing on a train today. So some of them were travelling to or from visiting their family, caring for elderly relatives, mm-hmm. some of them. They were going to or from work. Some of them commuted from Edinburgh to Dundee, so they were travelling for work. And some of them, when they were found, still had belongings in their pockets, which, for some reason, that makes them even more real, and I don't really know why.
Yeah, it shows they're just going about their business, doesn't it?
There were some children who were killed, who were there with their parents and grandparents, all ages, all different walks of life. One of the victims' families actually lived on the bank of the Tay, and when the train fell into the water, his mum was making dinner for her son, and she watched the flash when the train fell into the water from her kitchen.
Oh my God.
Now, as well as the search for the remains of the victims so that they could be buried properly, investigations started almost immediately to try and figure out what on earth had happened,
mm-hmm.
because this was just inconceivable. Kind of like the Titanic sinking. Like there's no way it could have happened. How mm-hmm. on earth did this happen? I imagine a similar feeling. But the Titanic was later. The Titanic was 1912. Divers went down to look for pieces of the bridge and to look for the train to just see what they could find. They were hoping to find bodies, but a lot of them weren't found in the train. They actually got washed sort of away by the strength of the water. Yeah. So they were found in other places,
uh-huh.
sort of down the Tay. And I don't know. Some of them were found in and around the bridge, but not all. But one of the things they wanted to do was to recover bits of the bridge and the train to try and suss out what went wrong.
Mm.
Had the bridge brought the train down, or had the train brought the bridge down?
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. So I wonder if the driver did anything.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know what he could have done if you want to really accelerate and decelerate a train, I think. But
well, yeah. Just to try and suss out who the fault lay with, really. Now, the high girders section, the metal tunnel that I've talked about a lot, this is the bit that came off. That was found in the water almost completely intact. And the train was found almost intact inside the tunnel.
So the thing just detached?
Now, we'll get into sort of what happened. That's how it was found. The train was inside the high girders and everything was almost, like, fine. I don't know much about how trains work, but I'll tell you what I found about what they discovered about the train.
Mm-hmm.
The regulator was fully open. The reversing lever was in the third position from mid-gear. And the brakes were fully off. So, if you're like me and you don't really know what this means aside from the brakes, this told the people who found the train that it was running completely normally when the bridge fell.
Mm.
The people driving it, they didn't try to brake, they didn't do anything. All of the positioning of the levers and everything suggested the train was running exactly as it should, and they were driving exactly as they should have.
Sounds like there's just a click. It was fine and then it wasn't.
Right. That's what they got from the train.
Yeah.
They do a similar thing to this when investigators tried to figure out how a car crash happened.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you look at the markings on the road. You know, like that bit in Hot Fuzz where he tries to say that they didn't put the brakes on, so it wasn't an accident.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like that. You use the road markings and the state the car's in to suss out whether or not they braked or if they're going too fast.
Mm-hmm.
This is a similar thing, but on a different scale. But basically what this meant, and I'm quoting this, they said that the driver could therefore have had no warning of the impending disaster he faced. So they had no indication anything was wrong.
Yeah.
Most of the damage that the train sustained was on its sides. So the sides of the carriages, and the carriages really came off the worst because they were wooden.
Oh, didn't picture that.
So the last two carriages were found in pieces,
mm-hmm.
and I read them described in the transcripts from the inquiry as matchwood.
Mm.
So they were in bits.
Yeah.
But other parts of the train, because it was made of metal, was reasonably fine.
Yeah.
Especially because it was inside the high girders. It was just in the water.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened? What on earth happened?
Well, that's the question, isn't it?
That was the big question that was on everyone's mind back in 1880. because this was the 28th of December. We're now into the new year. Bodies have been recovered and people are mourning, and the time has come to launch a full-scale inquiry into the failure to ensure that it could never happen again.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the Board of Trade that headed the investigation. And they went about it very, very quickly. As one of the criticisms of people in the modern day looking back at the inquiry, it happened over like a matter of months. It wasn't long at all. It was like 3 months or something.
Well, okay.
They didn't take a lot of time to look into everything fully. They could have done a lot more if they had taken their time. But they didn't want to hang about. People needed answers, and people were really emotional.
Absolutely.
They needed to know what had happened. And this inquiry was fairly extensive, but they were using methods that were quite new to inquiries like this. It's 1880, so this was one of the first times they were seeking out lots of eyewitness testimony and photographs and samples and mechanical tests. This hadn't really happened before.
Well, when it's the first engineering job of its scale, it's probably one of the first times something of its scale went wrong, isn't it?
Now, bridge collapses had happened.
Uh-huh.
That was a thing.
They'd done it 50 years prior.
Exactly. And there was lots of issues initially with the railway because it wasn't a very finesse system. So for a long time, collisions on railways were hugely common. It was a big problem.
That's terrifying.
Yeah. But this type of inquiry was reasonably new. They were really going into depth to find out what happened. They spoke to people who lived near the bridge, the people I was telling you about, and they heard about how the lights and lampshades in their homes shook when the bridge came down.
Oh, man.
And the people were talking about how their chimneys had been knocked over by the wind, which helped back up the claims that the weather was really bad that night.
That makes sense.
And a lot of these people that they questioned saw the bright light, but didn't know what caused it at the time.
That's what I want to know.
They just saw the flash on the bridge. From what they were able to tell, it was sparks caused by the carriage on the moving track. Or as things were grinding, they were sparking.
Mm.
It was quite difficult to tell.
Yeah.
But it seemed to have been sparks caused by the friction or the movement of metal.
Fuck.
Mm-hmm. As well as the evidence that they took from the collapse in the water and the eyewitness testimony, the commission also heard from people who had worked on the bridge.
Interesting.
To build it. And what some of them had to say was very, very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Some workers claimed that when they had been painting the bridge, so everything was all built, they were just painting it to... It like maintains the metal if you paint it.
It stops it rusting when there's paint on it.
They were painting it. And when they were up there painting, up in like the high girders, there was an awful lot of motion that they could feel. And they described it as being, what was it? It was like wobbly motion, like horizontal and vertical. It was bobbing like up and down a lot.
Interesting.
In like bad weather, which they noticed.
Yeah.
And they noticed it in windy weather, but they also noticed it when trains were coming over. It moved an awful lot.
That's interesting. There is a certain amount of movement in these things.
Yes, there is. They account for that because that's what stops it from snapping.
Yeah.
But they noted there was a lot of motion. So I think it was more than they were used to.
Uh-huh.
And they also spoke a lot about, like I just said, the vibrations caused by trains crossing.
Mm.
And it came out that before the collapse, a lot of the time, the trains were not sticking to the 25 mile per hour speed limit that was on the bridge.
Oh.
So if you're going faster, you're causing more vibration, which is making the whole thing move more.
That's not good.
So that was something that came out.
I imagined not knowing, like knowing it was the bridge collapsed and there was a train on it. I imagine it was being used for much longer. Like there was a lot more wear and tear involved, not just under 2 years.
It collapsed 19 months after it was opened.
A year and a half, even worse.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's not enough time for wear and tear and like bad maintenance and stuff.
No, which was why the inquiry was so important.
Yeah.
They needed to find out what had gone wrong.
Well, because they were planning on building another one.
Exactly. So they came to a few conclusions throughout their investigation. The main one being that the bridge brought down the train, not the other way around.
The bridge brought down. Okay, yep. Mm-hmm.
With me? I hope this isn't too confusing.
No, not at all.
One of the problems with the construction of the bridge were a thing called the lugs. This is where I'm probably going to lose you, because this is where I lost myself. But they were part of what held the columns together that supported the bridge. Kind of like bolts, but not.
Yeah, I forget what a lug is.
Oh, there's people going to be screaming at me, but this is the best that I understand it. However, there were issues with the lugs, the way that they were made. Apparently, the holes that the lugs had to go in were conical rather than cylindrical, which meant that with the stress of the wind, more pressure was put on them than there should have been had the holes been cylindrical.
Interesting.
But apparently, as a way to cut costs, Bush suggested making the lugs thinner than they originally planned.
Oh, no.
So the lugs were thinner than they were initially supposed to be, because then you needed less to make them and then you would save money.
Which would be what you wanted if you're end up being 80 million over budget. Exactly. 80,000.
Exactly. It's also been suggested that when Bush put together the design and the construction of the bridge, he didn't account for a thing called metal fatigue.
Okay.
There were occasions where things were broken during the construction, girders, things that were made of metal, and they were straightened and then used again.
Ah.
Which can cause, this is just my very basic understanding, but if you do that with metal, it weakens the part where it was bent.
Yes.
They didn't really know that this was a thing. So when things fell and broke, or didn't break, when things fell and bent, they just straightened them and reuse them. But they become weak spots on the bridge.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, it's like if you have like a paperclip, if you bend it back and forth, eventually it snaps at that point. It's that same thing. Right?
Well, I imagine it like bending a bit of paper.
Yeah.
At the crease, it's thinner.
Yeah, and if you crease it enough, it will snap.
Yeah. Is that, but on a massive scale.
Yeah.
With huge repercussions. The inquiry said that the bridge was not built to withstand the strength of the wind that it faced that night. They argued that if the pier, you know, the piers that were sunk into the water, they argued that they, if they had been built properly, then the bridge wouldn't have fallen.
Well, it's ridiculous because that's not unheard of winds. That's not winds. That's not, you know, the 10,000 year storm. That's just a storm. Up at that strength. Like, a fairly uncommon, but it's not that uncommon.
Well, I mean, when I brought it up, you knew what I was talking about.
Yeah. Like, I remember storms in Ullapool being at that kind of power.
But yeah, the inquiry basically said that you didn't do your job properly, and if you had, we have done the sums and can prove that the columns would have withstood the gale.
Oh, that's cold hard fact right there.
Which is very damning.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it hadn't been officially tested for wind pressure, like I said, but Bush designed the Tay Bridge using a wind pressure figure of 10 pounds per square foot.
Okay.
From what I can see. And what made this suspicious, because I have no idea about wind pressure, was when he was designing the fourth bridge, he used a wind pressure figure of 30 pounds per square foot.
Interesting.
So it seems like he didn't account for wind hitting the bridge like that.
Yeah. Which is a pretty core thing to worry about.
When it's when it's 2 miles long and the spans are as long as they are.
Yeah, across water. Got to think about that wind.
But remember I said Hutchison didn't test for wind pressure.
Yes.
He was let off the hook. Because in his document, he said he was going to. So he didn't face any blame.
Crazy.
Even though he didn't do the test.
Wow.
Because he could prove that he intended to do the test.
Oh.
So I don't know what the circumstances were that he didn't, but that was enough for him to be absolved of blame.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Because he was the inspector.
Yeah, that's true. He signed off on it.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you need like a good bit of wind to do the test, and it was a really calm day.
Maybe. I really don't know. I'd be interested if anybody does know.
Yeah. Just because then that was like, oh, well, I was going to do it, but it wasn't windy enough, so I physically couldn't do it.
Well, see, because if that's the case, then he knows that it's something that needs to be checked, but he couldn't check it.
Yeah.
Which would technically absolve him of blame.
Well, yeah. Because it's still, like, you leave a footnote, like, this still needs to be checked. Yeah. Generally.
So is it still his responsibility if he's left that in his report?
Yeah.
You know, probably for someone else to pick up.
Mm.
And then it never was.
Like, I'm not I'm not totally against him having his blame absolved.
No, but it does depend on the circumstances of why that test wasn't done.
Yeah, if he just, like, had an extended lunch break instead.
Because I have no idea.
Yeah.
The inquiry also suggested that the quality of the materials that had been used were not up to par. We're talking nuts and bolts, like down to the iron itself. When they tested it, they showed that a lot of the pieces, parts, and the metal had a lot of imperfections in it that meant that they shouldn't have been used, and they were.
Interesting.
So you can see it stacking up.
Yeah.
As you can imagine, Thomas Bush, Sir Thomas Bush, had a lot to say in response to all of this.
I was wondering what his crack's going to be.
Because he's not looking good.
No.
He was responsible for the bridge's design, its construction, and its maintenance.
Mm.
Everything's at his door. Now, Bush was convinced that the fault hadn't been with the bridge that night. He claimed that the reason the bridge had come down was because a second-class carriage from the train had derailed, had caught on a girder, and had ripped the bridge apart, and with it being windy, it came down.
Maybe.
And this is the kink in the rail theory for what happened. But the inquiry didn't buy it.
Yeah.
In the end, they blamed him almost entirely for what happened. And it was absolutely damning for him because this was his whole reputation. Because remember, he had designed the fourth bridge. It was still set to be built when the Tay Bridge collapsed.
Yep.
This is his entire livelihood. And in a move that, you know, was completely necessary, his design was completely abandoned for the fourth bridge. He had nothing to do with it anymore.
Good.
Two new engineers were brought on board. One of them was called Sir Benjamin Baker. They were taken on to redesign completely and build the fourth road bridge, or the fourth rail bridge, sorry. Now, Baker didn't hold back when he was asked for his opinion on what had caused the collapse of the Tay Bridge. He said it wasn't the wind at all, it was the bridge's poor design that did it. And a point that strengthened his argument was when the train itself was lifted from the water, a lot of the windows were still intact. The windows hadn't been blown out. So the wind pressure can't have been that high.
Got you.
Which put the blame firmly on Bush's design.
Yeah.
Not on the wind. Or not solely on the wind.
Oh, no.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, because you can't blame the wind when it's within the realm of possibility. It's not like 300 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm. Now, Bush died on the 30th of October, 1880. Less than a year after the disaster.
Oh, man.
And just a few months after the inquiry ended. He's claimed that his health took a serious decline after the disaster, and he never recovered. Because he was only 58 when he died.
Yeah.
And his reputation was in tatters. All of the bridges that he had built in the past, because there had been a few, they were all examined, reinforced, some of them were rebuilt. And that would be hugely embarrassing.
Yeah.
You're a professional, and you were a success, you were knighted. And now you have the teacher checking your work. And that's embarrassing.
That is embarrassing.
Especially after the deaths of all these people.
I know. Well, I'm not surprised he blames the train. Because how could you just stand up and be like, this is my fault. All these people died because I cut corners.
It's the right thing to do, but
I don't know many people who'd be able to.
No, because that's horrendous.
Yeah. To fully accept that it's your fault that they died.
Mm-hmm. Nearly 60 people.
Yeah.
Maybe more.
Crazy.
So the inquiry came to their conclusion. They blamed Bush.
Mm.
And life had to move on. Even though this disaster absolutely rocked the area. Because so many people knew the people who had died. And
yeah.
It's happening right on your doorstep. It has a huge mental impact on you.
And you're seeing the bridge every day.
Mm-hmm. But the new Tay Bridge was built just beside the remains of the first.
Mm.
And some of the pieces of the collapsed bridge were even used in the new one. Certain pieces that were deemed safe.
Yeah.
The engine of the train that fell was in such good condition when they recovered it that it was reused in a different train and was referred to affectionately as the diver.
That's really weird.
Mm-hmm. I don't quite know how I feel about it.
I mean, it's fair enough, really. It's thrifty.
Well, I guess it's, in its own way, I guess it's a symbol of kind of hope and moving on.
Perseverance.
That we're doing this anyway. We're moving forward. I don't know. I don't know how I feel about
it. Weird. It's very weird.
Now, the new bridge that they built had the height lowered. So instead of being 88 feet from the high water mark, it was 77 feet. And it had a double track, not a single. So it was wider. So the base was wider, which would make it more stable.
Yep, I think so.
And the testing that they had to go through on this bridge was unbelievable. It was so strict and thorough.
Mm-hmm.
They did everything and rethought everything and doubled down on everything. Approval for this bridge was given in 1881, so the year after the inquiry, 2 years after the collapse, and it was built and open by 1887.
Wow. Talk about back on the horse.
Mm-hmm. There was no ceremony. There was an official opening ceremony for the first one. This one opened with nothing. It just one day it was open to the public and that was it. It wouldn't be right.
No, there'd be some bad juju doing that, wouldn't there?
It was a really quick turnaround. And one of the reasons that they were able to build it so quickly was, you know, in the picture I showed you, you can still see the bottom of some of the columns.
Mm-hmm.
They were able to work from them. So they didn't use them in the bridge, but they could use them as a kind of work base to build the bridge beside it.
Ah, got you, yeah.
Because there, if you have taken the train over the Tay, you can see the old bridge.
I think so, yeah.
You can see it from the train. They're only 60 feet apart. And they were able to use, there was some kind of hydraulic system that they could use because they had a solid foundation to work from to build the second bridge. This is where it gets a bit technical. I've really tried, but that's probably about what you need to know.
Seems solid. Seems good.
Now, there were some things that were saved from the wreckage. There was a girder, I think, and personal belongings of people who died. They're on display in McManus Galleries in Dundee.
Oh, wow.
And sort of a spookier edge to the story is some people have reported hearing screams of passengers at night on the anniversary of the disaster from out on the water.
Grim.
And I think that legend's been on the go since it happened, pretty much.
Makes sense.
A memorial was built
to
commemorate the disaster and remember the people who died. There was a lot of hoo-ha over who was going to be named on the stones.
Oh.
Because like I said, they struggled to confirm who exactly was on the train. Uh-huh. So it's the name of the 59 people that they've confirmed that are on the stones.
Fair.
On the edge of the Tay. They're looking at interviews, that's what they thought seemed right. Because they can't prove anyone else.
No. And that's reasonable.
And the Tay Bridge disaster changed the way that bridges have been built since.
Yeah.
Wind pressure tests are a huge part of the testing process for every bridge. They have to be done. They have to be thorough. And like we said at the top, William McGonagall wrote a poem about the Tay Bridge disaster. And if you don't know, he's known famously as the world's worst poet.
Yep.
So enjoy that poem at your leisure.
Yep. Ailey reads it in, or part of it, in the Greyfriars Kirkyard episode.
I do.
Season 2, episode 1.
If you are interested in hearing that.
Mm-hmm.
All of that is the story of the Tay Bridge disaster.
Well, that was a journey. A train trip, if you will.
My mouth is so dry.
Good job. That was very well put together.
Did it make sense?
Yes.
Good. That's all I could hope for.
There was a bridge, it collapsed with a train on.
If I had just said that, you would have shot me.
Yep. You just said, is that it?
Yeah, that's all I understand. I've tried so hard.
An hour and three quarters and that's it?
Is it really that long?
Mm.
Oh my word.
I didn't.
I'm so sorry if you're still here. You probably have things to do. You have places you need to be.
Trains to catch.
Oh, don't. It's too spooky.
I know. It's going to be a bit iffy, like going over the Tay Bridge. If you get the train to Edinburgh, I think you go that way. Well, it depends which one, I suppose.
I don't think I've ever been over the rail bridge over the Tay.
I'm not sure. You can do any bridge.
I've never gotten the train to Dundee.
Because
Perth to Edinburgh doesn't go over the Tay.
Interesting.
I don't think, anyway. I could be wrong.
I'm not sure.
Let me know if I am wrong. pleased to hear it. But yeah, I don't know, I feel like more people should learn about it.
Yeah.
But maybe we were just raised in the wrong place. Like, maybe you do learn more about it if you live closer to Dundee.
Oh, that's true, eh? You probably, because it doesn't affect the Highlands particularly.
Well, not anymore, not in the same way.
No.
It was talked about really widely at the time, but,
yeah,
you know, it's that way that as time passes, it becomes less significant,
mm-hmm.
unfortunately, when it's something that should absolutely be remembered and talked about.
Maybe it is more common in schools down that way.
Quite possibly, I would believe it. Especially because you can see where the bridge was.
Well, yeah.
Well, it's very heavy and it's a very sad story, but yeah. I hope you enjoyed the episode and I hope you've gone away or you're going to go away having learned something you didn't know before.
Yep. And if you need comforting, get yourself some Burden Blends tea to drink.
Oh my God. It's not the time for a plug at all.
No.
So for now, we are going to head over to Patreon and discuss the episode.
Yes, we are.
So if you're interested in hearing that, head over to Patreon and come join us.
Yep.
But for now, we will speak to you next week.
We will. Bye.
Bye.